So hello everyone. So welcome to the last seminar in the Hillary term. So today is our pleasure to have Benjamin Gorch as the speaker. So Ben is a principal research fellow in machine learning at UCL and a tenured research scientist at INRIA. And he is also a visiting researcher at the Alan Turing Institute. So he's a member of ALIS Society and a fellow of Royal Statistical Society. So he's a leading researcher in PacBase. So personally, I have read many of his papers on PacBase during my PhD study. So today he will tell us more about PacBase and the new research in his group.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jun, for the very nice introduction and for the invitation, which I'm afraid has had to be postponed over the past few months. Certainly wish I were in Oxford at the moment to meet with all of you, but things are like they are. I'm very pleased to present a short overview really of what PacBase is. As I was joking a few minutes ago saying that it certainly is much more popular than used to be 10 years ago when I was doing a PhD on the topic, but still I appreciate that. I think it's good to have maybe a kind of a refresher on what PacBase theory is and can bring in particular to machine learning and statistics. And then I'll cover also a few recent results from my group. So I should say also as a disclaimer, if you do have any questions, please unmute yourselves. I'm afraid I'm not quite sure I can see if you type in the chat, but please feel free to interrupt me if you do have any question. Right, so you should see my slides moving forward. So yeah, as I was saying, so I'm a researcher affiliated with INRIA in France, so the National Research Institute for Computer Science and Mathematics, and UCL since 2018, where I'm one of the members of the Center of AI, which is recently inaugurated. So we're based in Heilbronn in London. And I also serve as the scientific director of this joint venture between France and the UK called the INRIA London Program. So if you are even remotely interested in hearing more about that, please feel free to get in touch. I'd be very happy to. So my research sits at the crossroads of statistics, I hold a PhD in statistics, but also more recently, optimization and application to machine learning. So the few keywords that I'm highlighting here are statistical learning theory and PacBase, obviously, as you will see, this is the core of my research contributions over the past years. I also have a keen interest in computational statistics, and much more recently, I've taken an interest in theoretical analysis of deep learning, as you will see. So we were able to obtain generalization bounds for some architectures of deep neural networks. So as you will very much gather from my talk, I hope, my personal obsession is absolutely generalization and what it entails for a series of problems in machine learning and statistics, how it can translate also to obtaining better theoretical understanding of some algorithms and also drive new algorithms. Sorry, I'm trying to, so June, I still get the notifications to let people in, but I don't know if you're taking care of this. I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I'm checking the
waiting. Okay, sounds good. All right. Let me start with a very brief introduction and maybe a kind of a thought-provoking intermediary to the topic of generalization. So I'd like to start with a very bold claim, I'm afraid, so, which is learning is really to be able to generalize. And you all know this kind of classical pictures. I did it. So you all know this kind of classical pictures. This one's taken from Wikipedia, for example. And the crux of generalization is trying to understand from example, what can an intelligent system learn about what is underlying? And you pretty much all agree that if you do memorize what you've already seen, it's usually pretty bad, this overfitting in statistics. And generalization is precisely the opposite of that, is your ability to escape overfitting and trying to be able to understand what is underlying and to understand really what generalizing beyond the data sets truly means. So let me start also with a very small appetizer, really food for thought. There's been some evidence in the past few years that deep learning might be conflicting or even actually breaking statistical learning theory as we know it. On that very simple observation, so most neural network architectures trained on data set actually achieve a fantastic training error, very low training error, basically zero. And as statisticians, I mean, this should be a red flag, right? In the sense that it might not bode very well for the performance. This suggests actually fairly strongly overfitting, but this is not what happens. Surprisingly, they're able to generalize from massive data sets, so they do achieve actually excellent test errors. You might also know, of course, this kind of picture. This is very statistics 101. This one's taken from Misha Belkin's paper and also from Carthus. So you all know this kind of trade-off between actually increasing the complexity of your space of hypothesis versus actually optimizing the test risk. So the goal of statistics and statistical learning in particular is really to aim for that sweet spot right over there where you achieve the ideal trade-off between a good training loss and the best generalization ability. There's conjectures actually from a series of authors, but starting really with this very influential paper from Misha and co-authors, that this might actually just be half of the picture. So this is what the other half might look like. And the idea that they put forward is really that rather than that sweet spot, we should aim for some kind of interpolation threshold. So an explanation, a possible explanation for how massive architectures of networks actually generalize and generalize very well indeed, is that there might be this second phase, which they call the interpolating regime, in which you've, in nutshell, it's really hand waving, but in nutshell, you've learned the data so well that you start to be able to generalize slightly around the few data points that you already collected. So that's
Hi Ben, we can't hear you now. No. But it was working like 10 seconds ago.
Can anyone hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. No. Oh boy. Okay.
Now we can hear you.
It should be back. Can anyone hear me?
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Fantastic. I'm very sorry about that. My Bluetooth headphones just decided to go off. All right. The joys of going full online, I guess. Okay, so let me just resume on that picture. So this is the kind of conjectures that are being addressed at the very moment by PyBase. Another thought-provoking example, I think, is I'd like to focus on the semantic content of learning and the way that semantic representation can be used and leveraged really to accelerate learning and try to better understand actually how to generalize from a few examples. This is very much addressed by one of the big projects that I was very fortunate to join when I joined the UK 2 years ago, which is called Semantic Information Pursuit for Multimodal Data Analysis. So there's a lot of partners. Arno, in particular, in the department is one of the PIs of that project. And this is very much what we try to address. A third and last example is what I like to narrate as a tale of two learners. So for one specific task, let's assume that you have a deep neural network. So for a classical architecture, I'm not going to comment on that. This is all very classical to all of you, for surely. But so it's widely admitted now that for very simple tasks, such as identifying an item in an image, so say you want to identify horses in images, well, you would typically achieve accuracies which are excellent, basically 100%. And the way it works is usually through training samples, so hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of annotated images. Annotated is important here because you need some kind of way to ensure that data is curated. We'll see what this actually means in theory, because it translates in many ways in theory. And then you train this on your favorite GPU, and then you get a deployable deep neural network. That's the first contender. So that's contender number two. Who are also extremely good at identifying horses on images. Actually, they do achieve the same accuracy. They have 100% accuracy. And surprisingly, they're also able to do other things. So for example, they are very good transferring to other items which resemble horses, for example, zebras or unicorns. My three-year-old daughter is all about unicorns at the moment. So this ability is obviously very far from what you could expect from a deep neural network, especially with the same training samples. So training samples in that particular example is N equal 5 or 6, basically. So what I'm saying with this little tale is that there is a striking mismatch between theory and the way we actually use algorithms and the way we understand intelligent systems at broad. And this is very much where my research is sitting for the past few years and for the upcoming years, for sure. Trying to address that gap, trying to better understand how semantic representation can be used to leverage learning, how we can actually hope to aim for more intelligent algorithms in the sense that they would be much more frugal, require much less resources, and try to leverage more internal representation. So back to that original claim, learning is indeed to be able to generalize, but not from scratch. So if you do consider each learning task as a very fresh draw, being blind to context, then you're very unlikely to be efficient. So this is a call for incorporating structure and semantic information and what I like to call implicit representations of the world that we humans, for example, are using constantly without even realizing it. So the hope is that it very much drives a new series of algorithms, which probably we will be on the long run, but hopefully much more frugal in terms of resources. So that's very much where my efforts on PancBase also sit, in the sense that we would like to drive this with my group, we'd like to drive this actually from the theory and try to translate this into working algorithms. So that brings me to the part one of my talk. So again, a very short primer on what PancBase is. This is very much inspired by the tutorial that I gave with John Shotella over here on that slide. And this was at ICML 2 years ago. So let me start with very simple settings. And again, if you do have any questions or remarks, please feel free to unmute yourselves. I'm saying this for those who joined a bit late. Right, so that's a very simple setting. Again, bear in mind that pretty much all of what I will be saying also extends to much more complicated settings. So for example, I will restrict myself to a supervised case, but there are a few attempts for PancBase, in particular for unsupervised learning or contrastive learning. I'll touch briefly on this in the last part. But all right, so this is a simpler setting. I have a learning algorithm A. Let's assume that I have pairs of input and outputs. So again, super classical notations. I'm not going to comment on that too much. The underlying distribution P, this is the underlying data generating distribution. We just assume that we collect a sample of IED examples. And this IED assumption is, of course, extremely central and key in statistics. But you will see in the second part that we actually have a few attempts and successful contributions to relax that assumption. And this is also in the sense of translating this into much more working algorithms and more realistic assumptions. So let me start briefly with, again, a very broad overview of statistical learning theory. So let me take just this example. If you fix an algorithm A, if you fix the function class H, if you fix also the sample size, what you could play with is generating random samples and then just looking at the errors. So you look at the test errors from those samples. And statistical learning theory is all about trying to understand the behavior of that sample. So rather than focusing on the mean, what makes a lot more sense is to focus on the tail of the distribution of those samples. So what you want to do ultimately in statistical learning theory is finding bounds which hold as high probability statements of our random samples. If you compare this to a statistical test, it's basically the same kind of interpretation. So if you do assume that you have 99% confidence level, say, The chance or the conclusion of what a statistical learning theory bound might tell you not being true, those are less than 1%. So this is the way you should interpret those high probabilistic statements. And this is the celebrated PAC framework. So PAC stands for probably approximately correct, can be traced back to the 80s with Valiant. And basically the way it goes is you would typically define a confidence parameter delta so that you can control the probability of making a huge mistake. If you can control this by delta, then you understand the phrasing high confidence as if you take the complementary set of that event, then the probability of being not in the case of a large mistake, so approximately correct, I've commented on this in a couple of slides, then this probability is actually arbitrarily close to one. So that's why I like to claim as well that statistical learning theory is about controlling what happens to the test error with high confidence. What can you achieve from that particular sample? So you can do basically two things. You can first learn a predictor. So you can train a machine learning algorithm, which delivers a predictor or an estimator. And then you can certify this performance. So by learning a predictor, I mean that you could train your algorithm using any kind of learning principle. So this covers pretty much everything that you could think of. You could have regularized methods, naive Bayesian techniques, deep neural networks, and so on and so on. This can be informed or not by prior knowledge. But the crux is you can also certify the performance of that predictor. And this is typically what is addressed by generalization bounds, as you will see now in a minute. So those two goals obviously interact a lot with each other. And this science research is pretty much very much involved in the interplay between those two goals and how you can use one to leverage for the other. So I'm now closing into the actual definition of what a generalization is. So again, this is all very classical. Please feel free to ask questions or make remarks, or maybe I'll go slightly faster on this. But so again, very classically, we use a loss function to measure the discrepancy between the actual output y and what you do predict for y. So with this very simple notation, that's h evaluated in x. And obviously those are random variables. So if you want to be able to make comparison between both, you take the expectation. That's what I'm going to call the out of sample risk, or R out. So the expectation with respect to the underlying distribution of data. And obviously you can't compute that. So you resort to the empirical counterpart, the in sample risk. Generalization is answering that question in the middle of the slide. If you have a predictor H which does well on the pairs that you've collected so far, will it still do well on new pairs? If you do collect new data points, will it still perform reasonably good? And for that, we use what we call the generalization gap, which is simply the difference between the outer sample risk and the end sample risk. A probabilistic statement, as I was mentioning before, might be in the form of upper bounds like that. So there's also a lot of research on lower bounds. I'm not going to touch on that in this talk. But basically, those upper bounds come with a series of flavors. So this epsilon term is actually the one which is of the utmost interest, obviously, in those results. And the different flavors I'm going to be touching upon are either distribution-free or distribution-dependent, in the sense that it might depend on the underlying distribution of the data, meaning that you could kick in actually additional assumptions on the underlying distribution of data. So for example, if you assume boundedness, if you assume the existence of kth moments of the data, if you assume a linear dependence between X and Y with the Gaussian noise and so on and so on, those are all model specifications and the band can be made tighter and tighter with those assumptions. But hopefully the band should also be valid with a minimal set of assumptions, if any, really. The other kind of flavor that it comes in are the algorithm-free or algorithm-dependent flavors, in the sense that this might be true only for a specific H, or it could be true for a very wide range of H functions. And if this is the case, I think you already see this coming. That is, you can optimize the bound for the specific H that you would be more inclined to use. So getting back to the PAC framework, so in a nutshell, this is a kind of prototypical form of PAC bounds, not yet PAC base. So with high probability, with probability arbitrary close to one, really. The generalization error of an hypothesis H, which is these blue parts over here, so the generalization gap as we had before, is at most this term, this epsilon term, that we can control, and hopefully in good cases, we can also compute, not just control. So you could think of this as a measure of complexity of the problem that you're looking at. And this typically scales, I see someone typing in the chat, actually. I do see the notifications. Could you provide an example of a distribution-free or distribution-dependent approaches? Yes, absolutely, but that's gonna come in a few slides, if that's all right. All right. Feel free to unmute yourselves if you got that. All right, so those statements are really high confidence statements on the tail of the distribution of this R out random variable. All right. Again, keep in mind that this is very similar to what you would achieve a statement from a statistical test at level one minus delta. So PacBase. So here comes PacBase. PacBase is really about pack generalization bounds, not just for hypotheses, but rather for distributions of a hypothesis. So hence connection to Bayes statistics. But as you will see, PacBase is actually fairly different from Bayesian inference. So let me also try to convince you, if you're not already at this stage, that you should, as statisticians or machine learners, you should care about generalization. In the sense that generalization bounds really are a safety check. The way I see it, they would give you a guarantee for data that you have not yet collected, or you might not even never collect, but they give you a theoretical guarantee of the performance of one specific algorithm on any unseen data. And as you will see, the most interesting cases of generalization bounds are when they provide this control, which is computable. So if you can actually compute numerically the right-hand side of a generalization bound, then you're in business, basically, because you would have the tightest kind of control that you could hope for that particular algorithm. They also explain why some algorithm actually work. If you want to explain why some algorithm don't work, you're more interested in lower bounds, but as for upper bounds, they do explain why some of them actually work. And as I was saying, if you are able to optimize the right-hand side of the bound with respect to the hypothesis or something even more complex, really, then it can lead to designing new algorithms. I'm going to be commenting on this in a minute. So at this stage, this is a take-on message. I very much hope that I will convince you that PacBase is a framework which is extremely generic in the sense that you will see that it's been applied to a lot of frameworks in statistics and machine learning. The only thing you need to do to apply really PacBase reasoning is to be able to define distributions of a hypothesis. And once you've done that, you can basically use the PacBase machinery and then try to derive bounds. So it really much is a technique to think about what generalization means for those algorithms. As I was briefly saying, it has a Bayesian flavor. So it leverages the flexibility of Bayesian trends, as you will see. And so you can derive new algorithms from it. So this is, as I was saying, very much inspired by that ICML tutorial, but I should also say that we ran a workshop 2 years before at NIPS, where we, in particular, we highlighted and discussed the differences really between Bayesian inference and back Bayesian learning. UI was a panelist, by the way. I see that you're here. Hi, UI. All right. And so as I was mentioning as well, if this is something of interest to you, so we do have quite a few openings in my group here in London, but I'd be very happy to elaborate on this during the questions maybe. So before jumping into the formal definition with a fact base, let me just briefly remind you what generalization bounds without PacBase look like, hence answering the questions before, distribution-free distribution-dependent approaches. So this is the very simple building block of generalization where you have basically just one hypothesis. It's obviously not very realistic, but you have to start somewhere. So this is a very classical result. So what it says is that the generalization gap with high probability will be no more then the log of one of the confidence with which you state the inequality divided by the square root of how many points that you have in your training set. So this scales as one of the square root of m. And this is a very simple example. If you do have a finite function class, which is, again, in a sense, a very worst case approach, those bounds are extremely conservative. I remember discussing this with a colleague recently, that those bounds are actually a worst case approach. They consider that the worst situation that could arise is this rate. In practice, although, the rate conditions might be even better. The performance might be actually even better. So again, illustrating that mismatch between between the theory and algorithms. This is something which has guided me for as long as I remember, really. So you know, you all know those classical results on generalization building during the 60s, or for example, the Wapnick-Shovanenkis dimension, Rademacher complexity, and all those techniques are actually targeting specific algorithms. So those are very much algorithm dependent approaches and rather than algorithm free. The algorithm free comes more with a pack-based approach, as you will see. So those techniques take some account of the correlations between the different hypotheses. If you have a finite number of hypotheses, or even if you have an infinite function class, or even countably, and they do take some account of the correlation, but quite imperfectly, to be honest. And so this is where pack-based also brings in something new. As I was saying, pack-based considers distributions of hypotheses rather than hypotheses. And so you have a perfect control on the correlations between the different hypotheses. All right.
Last question.
Yeah, please.
So did you just say now that the VC dimension and Rademacher complexity were algorithm dependent? Is that what you said?
No. I was saying that those bounds over here on this slides are I got confused between distribution and algorithm dependence. No, those bounds are valid whatever the algorithm.
Yes. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. I'm not quite sure what I said. Maybe I misspoke on this. Thanks for catching this. All right. So no. Coming to what is probably the most thought-provoking slide of my talk, at least this is always the slide that ends up being discussed, in particular by Bayesians. That's my attempt at summarizing the key differences between Bayesian statistics and pack-based. So on the top of the slides, you get a very summarized interpretation of what Bayes inference is. So by defining a prior distribution and specifying a statistical model, so typically a likelihood function, you get in a unique way, up to a normalization constant, obviously, but you get in a unique way the posterior distribution, which is the object of interest in Bayesian statistics. And by unique on this slide, what I mean is that if you do pick a different prior, then the whole inference machinery is very likely to be fairly different. If you pick a different likelihood as well, this is very likely to lead to much different results. And as a matter of fact, the likelihood and the prior are chosen very carefully in Bayesian statistics. And that choice is not independent from each other. There's a very rich literature on eliciting proper priors, targeting different statistical models, leading to efficient inference through the posterior. In pack-based, there's a considerable shift. So I should just say as a disclaimer that we do use prior and posterior in pack-based, but they have nothing to do really with proper Bayesian priors and proper Bayesian posteriors. So pack-based is also a model-free approach in the sense that it does not require to have a statistical model. There is no likelihood function. The only thing that you're using is loss function. So you could argue that the loss induces a likelihood, but even if you don't need to define it analytically, you can actually never consider this as a proper likelihood. So the prior distribution is just a way, just a measure to explore the state of hypothesis. So this is what I mean by exploration mechanism. It's just a way to navigate within the hypothesis. It doesn't need to actually be built with a particular inference scheme in mind. It doesn't need to be that. The posterior is really the twisted prior after confronting with data, just as much as in Bayesian statistics. But as you will see, there's also a line of work in PacBase which consider data dependent priors, for example. So what I'm saying here is that the vocabulary is the same really, but the object is fairly different. Also highlighting the differences between Bayesian inference and PacBase. So as you will see, the PacBase bounds will hold whatever the prior, whatever the posterior, and whatever the data generated distribution. And this is a massive difference. As I was saying earlier, the choice of the prior and the likelihood function, for example, has a massive impact in Bayesian statistics. So you cannot just pick anything and then use the same machinery. So that's a very salient difference between Bayes and PacBase. So I'm gonna consider from now on a prior P and a posterior Q, which only needs to be absolutely continuous with respect to P, so whereas there's a typo here. And the risk, as before, was defined for a hypothesis. If you now want to consider the risk of a whole distribution, well, we just basically integrate those previous divisions of the risk with respect to the posterior. And if you want to measure the discrepancy, not between just two hypotheses, but rather between two distributions of hypotheses, then you need to resort to divergences. So most of the PacBase literature is holding for the Kobach-Leibler divergence, as you will see in a minute. I should also say that there's a few attempts in the literature to extend this and go beyond the KL and have actually much more general classes of divergences. Here we are. This is now finally, after half an hour, the first classical back Bayesian bound. So the prototypical bound from David McAllister from this series of papers at the end of the 90s. And the prototypical form of a back Bayes bound is holding, as we're saying, for any prior P, any confidence level, the probability for the generalization gap to be at most this term over here, this big square root right there, where this probability is arbitrarily close to one. And again, this holds whatever the posterior. So this for any prior and for any posterior is actually extremely important in PacBase because as you could imagine, this opens the way to optimizing the bound for the best posterior distribution in some sense. Are there any questions so far? Any remarks or comments?
Excuse me, this is a bound for the bounded loss function in 0 and 1.
Yes, yes? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So I was touching earlier on how PacBase actually may use to drive new learning algorithm. Most PacBase bounds, we have this shape. So basically, in the left hand side, the error and the unseen data, so the error out quantity. And on the right hand side, this empirical error plus complexity term. If you can compute that complexity term, if it either has an analytical form or you can approximate it reasonably, yes, I see a question from UI.
Hi, Ben. What's the definition of the risk of Q?
Oh, sorry. I went a bit fast on that. So the risk of Q, the risk of a posterior distribution or any distribution okay. for that matter, is just the integrated That's version. Smart. So the expectation with respect to Q.
Thank you.
Okay. So yeah, if you can actually compute the right-hand side of the bounds, it gives you a principled way to derive new algorithms in the sense that you can just solve the right-hand side for Q. So this gives you say, a Q star distribution, and then you sample new hypothesis from Q star. So it's a randomized process. You define the distribution and then you can just sample from the distribution or look at the expectation of the distribution or mode or the median or whatever. What it tells you is the optimal distribution to make the bounds the tightest really. So by using algorithm sample from that Q star distribution, you have the guarantee that the right-hand side of the generalization band will be the tightest. So it's an optimization problem. There's been a few attempts at trying to solve it over the years. I've been mostly working with Monte Carlo Markov chain techniques and algorithms back in my early days as PhD student. There's also a very great line of contributions using variational inference, including also people in departments, obviously. And mostly what I would call gradient descent flavoring methods. They come in a variety of shapes and colors, really. But there's a few techniques out there to try and solve that problem, or at least approximate it. One remark, because I think it closes very nicely the loop in the literature. There's a few algorithms, very classical in statistics and machine learning, which have all been found to be minimizers of back basebands. And I think it's remarkable because those algorithms are actually much more ancient than backbase, which is 25 years old. But for example, SVMs or exponential weights, for that matter, have been found to be minimizers of specific back basebands. So it gives also a very nice way to justify the use of those algorithms. I think I'm running a bit low on time, so maybe I'll skip this. This is a central result in backbase, the Legendre transform of the KL divergence, which gives you an explicit formula for the distribution which actually maximizes this quantity. And this is the Gibbs distribution, which is again very classical in statistics and mechanical statistics in particular. So I'll go very briefly on this result due to Shizar and Dunston-Verdan in the 70s. And this actual formulation is due to Olivier Catoni in one of his funding books really on backbase and the formalization of backbase. I'll skip the proof. It's very elementary, but I think it's quite an elegant proof. I always like to showcase it, also because it fits on one slide, which is not the case of that many proofs in my papers, I'm afraid. But just to comment on the last line, so you get at the top the statement of that lemma. If you pick that phi function to be some temperature times the empirical risk, and you rewrite that formula, you get that this distribution Q lambda, which is exponential minus lambda times the empirical risk times the prior, so basically a Gibbs potential, this is a Gibbs distribution right over there. This distribution is the arginf of this problem, this constraint problem. And this seems really reasonable, right? Because what you're doing here is minimizing the expectation of the empirical risk with respect to a distribution Q, plus a discrepancy between Q and P with some temperature parameter, but the discrepancy is the KL. This very much resembles what we're doing in regularization in statistics, for example. A lasso is not a different interpretation. It's exactly the kind of criterion that you're optimizing, a fit to the data plus a regularization term. So again, in a way, this cast backbase into a series of well-known techniques, well-known results in literature, and I think this is an interpretation that is quite nice. All right, so that closes the first part, that small primer on what backbase is. So again, the take-home message is that backbase is a way to understand generalization. It's a way to deal with distributions of a predictors rather than just predictors. And as I've discussed, so statistical learning theory is all about this high confidence control of the generalization. And what backbase allows to do is really to extend this to a series of frameworks. There's really a whole zoo of frameworks in which backbase has been used and has delivered generalization bands, which often are state-of-the-art generalization bands. It can also lead to new algorithms by minimizing right-hand side of generalization bands. You might think that this would lead to classical posteriors and classical algorithms. This is not always the case. So then there's a trade-off between what this actually gives you and how achievable and how computable those objects are. So again, the trade-off between theory and algorithms. Right, so this couples, as I was saying, a lot of tools from statistics, optimization, probability theory. And so I've been working backbase for about 10 years now, since I finished my PhD. And that was much less popular back then than it is now, I must say. I think one of the explanations for the surge of interest in bank base is that, to my knowledge, it's one of the very few, if not the only one, way to address generalization for deep neural networks, at least for some architectures of deep neural networks. Hence the very strong spotlight that Backbase has received. All right, what's coming next in the remainder of my talk is what we've been up to for Backbase. But maybe now is a good time to take a very short break and ask if there are any questions or comments.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So can you comment on, you know, I'm not very familiar with this formalism, but how does having a random procedure for picking your hypothesis relate to practice? Because it seems that the PAC framework, where you know, you have some kind of search procedure or selection procedure for picking one thing, is exactly what we do in practice.
Absolutely. That is an excellent point. And this is what I was alluding to when I was talking about the gap between theory and practice. So there's a lot of back Bayesian results which actually hold for realization of that posterior. So we call those de-randomized bounds, in the sense that you have that posterior, then you sample from it, and then you have one specific hypothesis for which you want to assess the generalization ability. It doesn't seem very sensible in practice. I don't know anyone who really does that to solve a particular problem. So there's also a whole series of bounds holding for the expectation with respect to posterior. So in that sense, the final predictor is not random, is the expectation of that distribution, which is called the posterior. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And this poses, but that's also challenging in some settings, because this might be a distribution which is not so easy to sample from or even to use analytically. So computing the mean of that distribution might also be a computational challenge, but I'll touch on this briefly in the following slides.
Okay, can I just have a very quick follow-up?
Yeah, please.
Taking a practical example, like, so you have a neural network and you like use random initialization and then you train with gradient descent. What is the prior? Is it the push forward of the initialization by the gradient descent or something? What's the prior in this case?
It could be, yeah, it could be that, absolutely.
Right.
It could be, it could be anything really, because the back baseband will hold whatever the prior. So what you want to do ultimately is pick the prior which would make the band the tightest.
All right, okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Well, I have a similar question if we have time.
Yeah.
So what's the, sorry.
Yeah, no, please go ahead. I'm not quite sure how we do on time anyways, but I'm okay. Very happy to.
So what's the meaning of this prior distribution in real life? So this is the most confusing part of big base bounds for me, since we can choose it like anything, pretty much.
Yeah. So, okay, let me ask you a question by another question. If I go back to this, for example, so the very classical back base bounds, this is a probabilistic statement. But if this term over here in the square root. So let's assume that I'm in a binary classification problem. This is actually the case for this kind of bounds. So this is a number between 0 and 1. This is a test error on the binary classification problem. This is also a number between 0 and 1. And this might be something that blows up. So if you pick a prior, which is very far from the posterior, for example, in the KL sense, then this will blow up. And then your bound will be with probability close to 1, the generalization gap is abundant by 10 to the 30 or something. This is true. This is a probabilistic statement, which is true, but it's absolutely useless. So then we say that the bound is vacuous in some sense. So the past few works on PACBase have very much been in the direction of non-vacuous bounds, trying to ensure that we have something which is ultimately meaningful. And so the role of the prior in that sense is to try and make this complexity term as small as possible. So it could be informed by actual prior knowledge as in Bayesian statistics. It can be just the way you initialize, for example, your gradient descent for the weights of a neural network on the push forward phase. It could be pretty much anything like that. The bound will be valid regardless. So what's interesting is try and optimize for that prior when you want to make the bound tighter and tighter. I hope this answers your question.
Okay, thank you. I'm still confused, but it's better.
When we translate this into, please tell me to stop if you want to carry on with your talk. When we translate this into practice, suppose we're trying to analyze a situation where somebody does a specific training procedure. In order to get a bound for that procedure, do we try to find the prior that most represents what they do? Because it seems like what you've given here is a method for finding a way of a good prior and a guarantee if you pick the prior in such a way. But then you're going to use this to talk about other things that people do in the real world where they come up with algorithms that are not necessarily derived in this way. So how do you match them up?
So that's also a very good point, but I should maybe, take a step back and highlight that even though we call this prior, it doesn't need to be an actual prior in the Bayesian sense. When I'm saying this because, for example, if you have a class of hypotheses which are, deep neural networks, and what you want to do is learn the proper weights of that neural network, it might correspond to prior knowledge. But what if you had, you have a finite collection of predictors. You have one neural network, you have one decision tree, one random forest, one whatever. Then the prior is just possibly led by, the computational cost of using any of those experts, right? So it doesn't correspond to a specific knowledge of your problem. It's rather driven by, for example, computational constraints. It could be something like that. So I think what is always quite confusing in PacBase is that we do call this a prior, even though it might be an object which is fairly different from prior and Bayesian statistics. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm just wondering how this bears on practical situations. So how do you put this in a form? So if you suppose you take this standard Rademacher bound, right?
Yeah.
And you want to like just naively apply it to a neural network. Well, you calculate the Rademacher complexity of the neural network and then you put it in. And so I'm saying we have some algorithm that someone does in the world. We have to pick the P to correspond to what they're doing in order for this statement that's on the screen to give a generalization guarantee for their procedure.
So the short answer is no, you don't need to do the same. But if you want this to be a fair comparison with the Rademacher complexity based bounds, then it's probably a good idea. Does that make sense?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Well, thanks. All right. I'm going to be touching actually very briefly on some of the recent contributions because I think I'm running out of time, I'm afraid. But I'll try to wrap up quickly. So I've been extremely fortunate to work with all those fantastic people over the past few years. And so I'll probably just pick one because I won't be able to cover all of those, obviously. So I'll probably just briefly touch on the third one, actually, this paper, Decodomize and Generalize, which is a back Bayesian attempt at understanding binary activity in neural network. So just to briefly also give some context on the other work, so we've had contributions from a theoretical perspective trying to obtain back Bayesian bounds with different divergences, for example. So this is the first paper with Pierre Alquier, who's with Riken in Japan, where we have back Bayesian bounds holding for what we call hostile data. So either heavy-tailed or dependent, so relaxing that ID assumption, which obviously is extremely useful in statistics, but not very realistic in the real world, obviously. There's also a line of work towards different back Bayesian bounds. So either with faster rates, this is this paper with Zach Mamede and Peter Grünfeld, and also different measures of the loss. So for example, I've been touching upon the fact that the risk is mostly the expectation of a loss. But again, this might not correspond to situations where you want to optimize a different quantity. For example, in medical drugs testing, rather than the expectation, you'd be much more interested in the quantiles of that loss, right? Because you want to avoid at all costs costly errors or possibly leading to death of patients. So the expectation, just taking the average of a distribution, might not be a very good idea in those respects. So we have that paper at Last NeuroRips on PacBase for the conditional value at risk in particular. So different ways to measure the performance. We have also a series of contributions for structured predictions. So echoing what I was saying earlier about the need to incorporate structure and semantic content into learning, and also this fact-based contrastive technique, which appeared at last UAI with Pascal Germain and Kanto Nozawa, also from Japan. So what I'm highlighting here is the range of contributions that are accessible through a PacBase. And again, the only thing to use the PacBase machinery is to be able to define a probability distribution, a measure on the space of hypotheses. If you can do that, then you can adapt the PacBase framework straightforwardly. All right, so I'll just take in the 3-4 minutes, just give a very brief overview of that one. So let me just skip all of that. So the binary activated neural networks is just a very classical forward neural network, fully connected. The only thing is that the activation function is the sine function. So at each node, you output either one or minus one. This is a challenge because it's obviously non-differentiable. So the way we address this with PacBase is with a small trick, which is, as in PacBase, you're mostly looking at the expectation in many papers, you're mostly looking at the expectation with respect to the prior. This turns out to actually have a closed form. So the expectation of the output of a neural network with a binary activation is actually the error function. And that was the beginning. So this is a fact pointed out by an earlier paper from François Laviolette and Pascal Germain in 2009. And this little fact here is at the core of that contribution because it allows us to both write a PacBayesian generalization bound for that specific architecture. We use also a few tricks in the bounds. So for example, the KL divergence term has a closed form if you assume that prior and posterior are Gaussians with parameters. So you basically it amounts to optimizing for those parameters to try and control the discrepancy between the prior and the posterior. This is the very simple toy case of just one layer, so no hidden layer really for neural network. But this is just a teaser. This really is the building block in that paper. And ultimately we're able to derive a full strategy to write the gradient descent training of the network and the transition band, which is right there. So that's the transition band. So it's a very, I see questions in the chat. What is QW? So QW is the posterior on the weights W. That's the posterior distributions. So the transition bounds that we have for that specific architecture of a neural network is very much inspired by a bound from Olivier Catoni. And it basically tells you that the ensemble risk at first approximation, the ensemble risk of the neural network is far from the outsample risk by a margin, which is the KL divided by M in that context. So this really much is consistent with the remaining of the theory. What was interesting in that is that we're able to derive the actual value of that bound in a series of settings. So let me just briefly zoom in because I want to leave some time for questions. I realize we're closing in on the hour. So this is a sample of the few numerical experiments that we did with that particular architecture. So if you look at this column, for example, let me zoom in. So this is for variations of NIST as a baseline. So this is the PacBase inspired neural network with a binary activation function. What you get on the first column is the empirical risk on the different instances of the data set. This is the test error, and this is the value of the bounds. And when I was saying earlier that we very much see generalization bounds are the theoretical guarantee which translate into working tool for practitioners, this is very much what we hope to achieve. As a practitioner, if you enter the empirical error achieved by some algorithm on some data set, what PacBase gives you in return through, of course, a lot of different steps that I will not elaborate too much on. But what it gives you ultimately is the value of the bound, which is an upper bound with probability, with a confidence level. So in this case, it's 99%. So with 99% on this particular problem, I compute the empirical error, which is 1.8%. And PacBase theory tells you, all right, if you collect any new instances from that data set, the error will never be more than 3%. And this occurs with probability 99%. So there's also a very recent paper from my good colleagues and friends at UCL, Omar, John, and Maria, talking about certificates for machine learning. And this very much is the idea of those kind of statements. Judith is asking, what was delta? So delta is the temperature. I'm guessing you're asking, oh no, sorry, you're asking about this delta, right? So the confidence parameter. And the confidence parameter is the probability with which you state the upper bound. So delta is something morally very close to zero. The closer to zero it is, and the more likely this is to blow up, obviously. So there's a trade-off. Yeah. All right. I think I'll wrap up here. So just to give you very an attempt at summarizing these different lines of research. So as you understood, the quest was very much for generalization guarantees. About half of the contributions from my group are with PyQuery. So this is the tip of the iceberg that you see now. And the few directions that I've been extremely interested in over the past few years are providing either generic bounds in the sense that it would be holding under a less restricted set of hypotheses such as ID or something like that. Also tighter bounds for specific algorithms. So if you pick a specific algorithm, it's reasonable to hope that you will have tighter rates, for example, or tighter constants in the bounds for that particular algorithm. Also briefly mentioned the new measures of performance such as condition of layered risk or contrastive losses. And again, the interplay between coupling the theory and the algorithm is very much at the center of our team. Last but not least, the applications that we foresee for that is really much towards what I like to call sustainable machine learning, in the sense that if you have a guarantee that with that many data points, the best you could achieve as a test error or an estimate of the test error with probability 99%, for example, is this, then it gives, I think, very valuable guidelines to machine learning practitioners and users of algorithms. So I think I'll close up here. Thank you very much. Right on time. It's 4:30. And I'd welcome any questions if you have any more. Thank you very much.
Thank Ben for the very nice talk. So we have a little time for some more quick questions from the audience.
I have a silly question. So you were at the beginning, you were explaining sort of just justifying the generalization bound to make a link with the double descent story.
Yeah.
Do your pack-based bound give some insight of the double descent or not?
So this is very much the hope in an ongoing work, which is not yet on archive, I'm afraid. But what we're trying to assess is if you do augment the complexity of the class, so if you do add, you know, layers and layers from your network, do you foresee at some point a decrease in the right-hand side of the bounds? This is very much what we're working on. And the answer is yes, but I'm afraid I don't have any more material to share at this point.
I see there's a question, Umut?
No, I don't have a question. Oh,
you had your hand raised.
So it was for clapping, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I think we already run out of time. So let's end this seminar. Thank you everyone for coming. So let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks everyone. I should also mention that the slides will be on my webpage very shortly, in a few minutes actually. And feel absolutely free to reach out should you have questions or comments.